was going to be tied up by my feet. The suffering was for his enjoyment. But he wanted to make it last as long as possible. He had no remorse.
You read about the case, you read about these chats, and you're horrified. And you're just like, this guy's a monster.
The idea of the cannibal cop wandering around with a badge was unbelievable. But there were two sides to this story.
Yeah, this is depraved language and unconventional thoughts, but there's no evidence.
It just sends a shiver down my spine.
What is the line between fantasy and crime?
Is he a harmless teddy bear of a guy, or is he a nefarious master criminal?
Welcome back to another edition of Docu Talk Through, the podcast where I talk you through the best documentaries in the streaming sphere. The title of the documentary for this episode is Thought Crimes, The Case of the Cannibal Cop. You can find this streaming on HBO Max. And Thought Crimes is about the probing look into the potential future of, quote, thought policing through the headline making case of the NYPD, quote, cannibal cop who was charged with conspiring to kidnap and eat women. You heard that right. So this is going to be an interesting one. Again, you can catch this streaming on Max. And this documentary is from 2015, just to give you a time reference. All right, let's talk through it. Okay, so we're starting out outside of these apartment buildings. We slowly pan into this dude sitting in front of a computer screen. And he's talking about when you're behind a computer screen late at night, nobody knows who you are, where you are. And this dude is talking about he became part of this cyber community where they explored like fetishes and all kinds of scumbaggery. He's talking about, I'm not the only one with these thoughts. And as he's talking about this, he's typing on the screen. So the site he's on, just to give you guys a little bit of what I'm looking at here, he's sitting in front of this screen. He's typing. His handle is MHAL52. And then he types, hi, it's girl meat, hun. And so he's conversating, oh, girl meat is girl meat hunter, planning on getting me some girl meat. That's what he's typing, right? And so the evidently this is like a bondage site, because the headline on the top title page of this website is Dark Fetish Net. And I've never been on any site like this. I forget there's shit out there like this, Dark Fetish Net. And at the top, it has the banner has this lady. She's ball gagged, and then she's hogtied. So her feet are tied behind her, her hands and feet are tied together behind her back, and she's naked. So this is the site that this guy's on. Now I'm thinking this must be this New York cop, but let me not get ahead. So he's exploring all this deviant, creep, scumbaggery shit. Yeah, I'm kink shaming. Like, you know, I know that's a thing. You don't supposed to shame anybody. So but that's just my opinion. I'm not into this hog-tying women shit. Or men. So we're looking at his profile, Girl Meat Hunter. That's his handle, Girl Meat Hunter. We can't directly see his profile. It's kind of like blurred out. Oh, no, actually, it comes into focus. So Girl Meat Hunter, birthday 17 June 1980, 32-year-old male. It says, about me, who am I? Picture from Dirty Deeds, Frozen Food. Favorite quote, tonight, my dear, you are the main course. So that's just give you an example of what this shit is going to be like. So he's trying to justify that, you know, I'm not the only one that explores these kind of fetishes, but whatever. So he's conversating with somebody, another scumbag like him, and he's typing in here like, I would like to get my hands on the stun gun, rape her, abuse her. This is the other person going back, de-breast her, I hope. She would be trusted up like a turkey and slid into the oven while she is still alive. Once she dies, I will pour her out and then properly butcher her and cook her meat. And so as he's typing all this on the screen, he's just going on talking about, yeah, you know, this is a fetish, a kink or whatever. You're anonymous. You play this role online. And then once you turn the computer off, you're done. You know, you go to work and live your normal day as a cop, principal, teacher, priest, whatever. That's pretty much what he's saying. All right. So now we move on from that night to now it's daytime. You know, we're looking at the New York skyline from the waters, and he's standing at the subway, and he's just saying, like, you know, in the daytime I go back to being the regular me. And now he's on the subway, and this dude looks like, he kind of looks like Homer Simpson. I'm not going to even lie, he looks like Homer Simpson. He looks like a sad, depressed Homer Simpson. And then he says somebody could say like the anonymous nature could bring out who you really are. And now he's back at it again. It's another night. He's back at it again, typing, "The sounds of her screams will be the sweetest music to my ears." Nah, man, unless you're writing a book, you know, or unless this is some sort of expressive art project or something, you know, whatever, man, nah. Like, why? What? Like, who has thoughts like that about just random people? It's not even, I could even understand, like, if it was somebody who wronged you, you just venting. But just random, just I want to do this just to a random person. So he's saying that somebody that would come across this, figure out who it is, in his worst nightmare, I would never have guessed that this would happen, that someone would discover this, break his anonymity, I ain't gonna lie, man, it's been a long day. If he breaks his anonymity, or someone breaks through his anonymity and find out he's doing this shit, that's his worst nightmare, that somebody would come across this and think that he would really do this in real life. All right, that's how we start off. All right, so now we hear this breaking news report, an almost unbelievable story. A New York City police officer has been arrested in a failed plot to kidnap dozens of women. Okay, so they're not even going to bury the lead. We're getting right into it. We're outside the NYPD police station, one of them, and they're just talking about all this shit I just read to you from what he was typing about. He wants to kidnap women, cook them, eat them. And they show this picture of this lady. She's hogtied. She got an apple in her mouth like a pig getting ready to be roasted, just like he was saying in his text in that form. So we have another reporter. She is saying, his name is Gilberto Valle. Gilberto Valle has become known as the cannibal cop. So wait a minute. Has he done this already? If he's already been known as being called the cannibal cop? All right. So his wife, the 28-year-old's wife, uncovered the alleged plot. So this dude's married. Okay. This dude's married. And his wife is on the cover of this headline, and she looks absolutely disgusted. What wife wouldn't? What girlfriend wouldn't? So it says, meet the wife. And meet is spelled M-E-A-T, the wife. Cannibal cop spouse testified.
Charged in a conspiracy to commit kidnapping and allegedly used NYPD computers to get information on a list of victims.
Defense lawyers did not deny his online activity, but called it a sexual fantasy that he would never act on.
These are thoughts, very ugly thoughts, but we don't prosecute people for their thoughts.
It comes down to this. Is this guy just fantasizing, or is there enough evidence to suggest he was really planning to do this?
Okay, so we started out with one thing, thought crime, to this dude is actually using NYPD resources to select victims? Nah, yo. Mm-mm. Okay, this is just a thwarted serial crime. That's what this is. This is not no fucking thought crime. If it's one thing if it just stayed on that forum where he was, you know, even that's scumbaggery, but you know, whatever. People got their kinks. But no, this dude is using his access as a cop to find victims. Because if this guy was planning, he was on a website talking about bombing a daycare or a mass shooting. What was some kid on his website talking about mass shooting, killing people, and then it didn't just end there. He was going to the library, selecting where he's going to do his mass shooting, and then, you know, I don't know if they found actually like duct tape and shit that he planned to commit this stuff. But, you know, in the case of this theorized mass shooter, they go to his house and they find out he has the tools to do this. That's not a thought crime, man. That's like you just stopped the shit before it happened. All right, let's continue. I know I'll be getting ahead, but all right, let's go. All right. So this guy, Gilberto Valle, the cannibal cop. So we hear this guy talking about there's nothing we like better in fiction than a killer. He's the worst, the meanest, the baddest. And this guy is Robert Coker. He's with the New York Magazine. So he's just talking about, you know, people love serial killers. People love that story of serial crimes and stuff like that. And you guys would notice I've never done a serial killer documentary. I don't get into serial killers. That's just me. I don't watch anything about serial killers. I don't get into them. But people are fascinated with serial killers for some reason. So this guy was probably one in the making. And as he's talking, we see, oh, he has a kid. Oh, man. So we see him just like a regular Homer Simpson type guy with his wife, and they're holding their baby. Like he has a baby daughter. They have her face blurred out, but I think she has on like a little dress. But so he's looking like a family guy. He doesn't look as weird as he did earlier on that subway. So this is probably before he got found out. He's probably all that stress and shit and all that embarrassment probably hasn't hit his face yet. But this reporter is just talking about there's story archetypes that we all sort of adhere to. And I've never heard of this case, but evidently it was all in the papers. We see this picture of him in the paper. It says Sicko's Secret Recipe. They have him on the cover of this headline with a Chef Boyardee hat on the top of the Chef Boyardee hat. It has Cannibal Cop on it. So I guess he went by Gil. So Gil, as the Cannibal Cop, was seen as like this master criminal, this Hannibal Lecter type dude, vicious beast, and he needed to be controlled. And we see another picture of his wife. She looks like she's in the back of a car. Her head is down. And man, she's just absolutely distraught. You would think she just came from a funeral, or you would think she's just, somebody just told her somebody in her family was murdered. That's how distraught she looked. Oh shit. So he was planning on abducting and eating his own wife in addition to other women. Oh man, this guy's walking around with a badge. And you know what the most fucked up part about it is? I guarantee you. So think about that. He just got caught. Think of people in these positions. You know, it's just one thing if a dude works at Walmart. You know, he don't have any power over anybody. But this dude's a cop. He's a fucking cop, man. He can pull people over. Matter of fact, there was an old episode of Cold Case Files from years ago, but it was on in the hotel. And it was the one of this cop who pulled over this girl. She was in the VW Bug, and he straight murdered her. Matter of fact, there's a whole series now on, I can't remember which streaming service, but there's a whole series called Good Cop, Bad Cop. And it's all about cops who were murderers, who were serial killers. So that's the thing. That's why it's so bad. You know what I mean? It's not just that, you know, he was on this site talking about all this creepy ass shit. It's the fact that he's a cop. You know, it would be the same if he was pretty much anyone in uniform who has authority and who people look up to. Anybody like that, you know, anyone in that type of position, but especially a cop, because again, a cop, he can pull over anybody. You know, you have a headlight out. Let me get your information. Next thing you know, he has this chick's information. He can go to a house. Again, he was already using his access as a cop to seek out women. All right, let me quit rambling. So at this point in the documentary, we're only like a few minutes in, and it already went to trial. So it's not about if he found guilty or not. I guess we're going to find that out pretty early. So this investigative reporter is saying, actually, he's just a magazine writer. So the defense was, this is a thought police case. And he's just talking about how theatrical the case was. And we're looking at the court drawing, you know, the court sketch. In this case, it looks like it's probably like colored pencil. We see a rendering of that darkfetish.net website. So he's just saying this case was the best that true crime has to offer. It was about psychotic, crazy human behavior. Okay, so now we go to this video of this baby. And this is, I guess this is, I'm gonna call him Gil, because that's what this guy called him. This is Gil at age one. So it's a video of him when he was a year old. And he looking like a baby Homer Simpson. So now we're looking at him at 30. All right, so I guess he's getting mic'd up to be interviewed. They're doing a mic check. So he's saying, when you hear about this story, you have this preconceived notion in your head about what this is about. The preconceived notion is that no one does this just for kinks. That's my preconceived notion. So he's saying that when you have that, and then, you know, he get discovered, you're going to start looking for facts to jibe with your preconceived notion. And so he want everybody to have all the facts so they can make up their minds for themselves and not find evidence to back up your prejudices. So he grew up in Queens, New York. His parents separated at an early age. And as he's talking, we see these home video footage of him as a baby as he's talking about this. And then from you know, what I'm seeing there, everything looks normal. So his mom was there for emotional support. His dad was there to kick you in the ass. He was very strict. They didn't want to disappoint his dad. And so we go from that to this reporter talking about the the evidence came out when the FBI found evidence of his plans to do this, to kidnap these women. And so now we meet his father. His father is on being recorded on camera, and he's pretty much in disbelief of he's shocked. And then the reporter asked him, is it possible? He said he don't think so. And so his dad is Gilberto Valle Sr. His dad is just asking the question, is he crazy? When shit like this happened, especially with adults, they always go and try to figure out the parents. You know, they always go to try to figure out the how he was raised. This motherfucker is 30 years old. None of that shit matter. He was married. He had a kid. So evidently he got a job with the NYPD. Anyway, so now we meet his mom. Her name is Liz Valle. And this interview is asking her, how did you feel when you heard?
You heard the first allegations about cannibalism and kidnapping.
I couldn't believe it. I said, that's not my son. I'm like, there's got to be a mistake. That's not my son. The first time that I actually heard these internet chats, that's when I noticed. I'm like, okay, my son did have a problem. For the good boy that I know to be discussing women in such a way, it was just horrible. But if anything, he needed help. See a psychiatrist, see a therapist. I mean, I'm not saying whether it's right or wrong, but, you know, some people choose to let out their frustrations by going to the gym, punching a punching bag. That might work for them. For some, it might be getting on a site like this and fantasizing, thoughts of horrible thoughts like that.
Well, he created a monster. He's a good writer. I mean, how can anybody believe that one person is going to kidnap 100 women and cook and eat 100 women? Which one was in the trunk of his car? Which one was in the spit over the fire? Which one was in the oven?
Again, if he was venting about one person or someone personally, like a female coworker, a boss at a female boss at work, something like that, you can say he was venting. All right, so we met this guy, Daniel Ingber. He's a writer for Slate. And he's talking about the fact that this guy is sitting in his apartment. His wife is in the next room. His baby's in the next room asleep. And he's on this website talking about slitting her throat. And the fact that he's walking around in his police uniform, that's what makes this. Yeah, man, just like I've been saying, that's what makes this different. Okay, so part of the evidence was, part of the defense was that when they got into his computer, there were a bunch of people asking, is this for real? You know, like, hey, you know, okay, this is all jibber jabber, but is this for real? And 21 times Gil said, no, this is fantasy. I'm just talking fantasy. No matter what I say, it's make believe. But so out of 24 people ask him, is this real? He only responded that this is fantasy in 21 of those. And so, okay, so in others, he said, yeah, this is for real. I'm just afraid of getting caught. Okay. I was about to give him a break, but nah. And then we see in this correspondence on this online, it says, if I were guaranteed to get away with it, I would do it. So that seems like evidence of a real conspiracy to do this. If this was 100% fantasy, 100% of his responses would have been, this is all fantasy. I'm just talking shit. I'm just venting. Matter of fact, let me get the hell up off here. Now we see Joseph DeMarco, former federal prosecutor. He's saying we don't have thought crime in this country. So there's thought crime in other countries. We don't prosecute people for what they think. It is permissible to have all of the thoughts you want from a criminal law enforcement point of view. You can have whatever thought you want to. What's impermissible is planning with another person to execute on those thoughts. Yeah, it's just like It's just like trying to hire a hitman and getting caught before the hit happened. What are you going to say? No, this is just fantasy. We just role playing. And so now we're looking at Gilberto's arrest warrant. It says, I'm trying to see what the actual charges. In violation of United States Code Title 18, Section 1201C. So description of charges, kidnapping conspiracy. Okay, so October 24th, 2012 is when that arrest warrant came out. So two charges brought against him: kidnapping, conspiracy, as well as unauthorized use of a law enforcement database in order to gain some information about one of the victims. Okay, so just one of the victims. So conspiracy is the prosecutor's favorite instrument. And that's what this guy said. In order to be convicted of an attempt, you have to not only intend to do it, you have to go beyond preparation. And this is Alan Dershowitz, Harvard Law School. So you got to cross that line to suggest you've taken steps to actually do this shit. That's what conspiracy is. And, you know, and if it gets thwarted, that's when it becomes a conspiracy. When you go so far to where someone has to put a stop to it, that's conspiracy. If you're just talking about this shit, doing something terrible, and you don't take any steps, you don't do any steps to do it, then, you know, it's just talk. Okay, so now there's this act called the Overt Act. And we hear this other person saying the Overt Act doesn't have to be a crime itself. It's not like you say, let's go rob a bank. An overt action is you steal a car. And this is Aaron Murphy, NYU School of Law. It could be an overt act, could be something that's actually lawful. It just might have special meaning here. Like, so an example, well, the real example that they transitioned to was, so in his chats, he talked about chloroforming somebody. And then also along, in addition to that, he searched how to chloroform. So that's the difference. When you go from talking to researching, and he's searching how to make chloroform. So you go from talking about stalking your victims to searching on the NYPD database as to where one of the victims live. That's stalking. He actually traveled to Maryland to visit one of the intended victims. And it was one of his college friends. And we see a picture with him looking like they had a tailgater or some sort of event, drinking beer. And he's taking a picture with her. This is one of his, they discovered one of the people that he targeted. We're talking to the court sketch artist, Jane Rosenberg. And she's showing some of these sketches of these nude bodies, and she's saying she don't, you know, a lot of times she don't get to draw nude bodies, but now she got to do people on spits, and we see this one of this lady wrote, you know, like a rotisserie chicken on a spit, women being cooked and roasted, visuals of darkfetish.net, and she's just showing all these sketches from the trial. And she says she's really never seen anything like that in the trial. We go from her sketches of this guy before we even see him, and now we see him, and the sketch looks just like him. This is Darea Gregorian, and he's with the New York Daily News. And he's saying there was reporters there from all over the country. They heard a lot about this case, but now all of it was being laid out in front of them for the first time. There were co-conspirators along with Gil. There was this guy, Michael Van Hees, and we see a picture of him. He don't look like a guy you would want to walk up to on the street. Somebody in Pakistan known as Ali Khan was another person. A man in England named Moody Blues. His screen name was Meat Market Man. And so we see MHL52 saying, I have a place in the mountains. No one around for 3/4 of a mile. Maybe we'll tie her to the rotisserie and cook her outside. And we still hear DeRay Gregorian, you know, talking about this. He had written plans out about kidnapping this woman and building a pulley apparatus in his basement, stringing women up and torturing them and slow roasting them. He had a giant oven that he planned on stuffing these women into. So we meet one of the jurors. Juror X, she's darkened out. You can't see her face. And she's just saying they had a tome. They just had a tome of evidence. And it was up to them to decipher, was this real or fake? Part of this evidence was that he had real pictures of people from his real life. And he was sharing this stuff with people online. He also had this thing called a blueprint. And he had all these pictures, all this material. He had everything, man. It wasn't just talk. This was a plan he was laying out. So it made it very real to show that the jury, that if this dude wasn't stopped, he was going to go and do this. So Gail had been stalking this girl named Alisa Frisker, and he's actually chatting about it. It's absolutely amazing to watch her come out of her school and follow her. So he'd been stalking this girl. $5,000 and she is all yours. Could you do four? So they're negotiating how much they want to sell this chick for. I am aspiring to be a professional kidnapper in debt's business. So they actually got to the point where they actually had dates. You know, they had dates that they were going to do stuff, but it didn't happen on those dates. And a bunch of the stuff that they talked about that they had, like the giant oven, the pulley, all this, they didn't have any of that shit. He didn't have any of the stuff in his blueprint. He didn't have the car. He didn't have the chloroform. He didn't have all this stuff. It was all made up. So that's what the defense is saying. This guy, they're trying to make it out. He was just this Looney Tune selling wolf tickets online. Okay, so the verdict, guilty of both charges, conspiracy of kidnapping and using NYPD resources. So they found him guilty. And we hear his mom talking. She's saying the first time that she's cried was right now on in this interview. She didn't cry when the guilty verdict came out. And she said he's not accountable. He never ate anybody. Okay, that's fair. That's fair. So I thought they were gonna come out and say he actually did this and ate one of these women. But yeah, so he went to prison and he broke down in prison. He didn't want to do it in front of his family. He wanted, you know, like a man. You do it in private. You cry in private, like what a real man. Okay, I give him props for that. And his defense attorney is a woman. Isn't that how it goes? Like if someone's on trial for some hate crime, whoever the hate crime is against, one of the parts of defense is to get a lawyer that's in that group. You know what I mean? Isn't that how it goes? Isn't it like a sign of guilt? Like if a person does a hate crime against a black person, then his lawyer's black. If somebody rapes and murder a woman, his lawyer's a woman. Isn't that like one of the tricks of defense attorneys? And so his defense attorney just laid. I can't remember her name. I don't even think they showed her name yet. I may have missed it. So he has two defense, you know, part of his defense team, this dude, Robert Baum. And he's just going on about the jury got it wrong, whatever. This is a human being. So Vale's defense motions for the judge to overturn the verdict, arguing the evidence was insufficient. Vale faces life in prison. Life in prison? Wow. They wanted to make an example of this guy. Life in prison. Damn. Okay. So now we hear a recording call from prison. And this Vale, it's Gil talking to somebody. Okay, the lead defense attorney named Julia. I think it's Julia Gatto. Okay, so to back up a little bit, going back to this overt acting, it seems like all we have, because all this stuff he was talking about he really didn't have. So now the only thing you really have, the only evidence is really him talking about what he's going to do and him searching about what he's going to do. Okay, so that's where we are now. So all that other shit about him having the blueprint, he got the rope, all that was wolf tickets. So I guess that's what the rest of this is going to be about. So he's just talking shit. He don't have any of this stuff. He don't have no cabin in the woods. Okay, so that was something going on in the house. Because evidently his wife was searching, my husband doesn't love me. So while they were looking, finding his evidence, they found out that there was something going on with the marriage. Okay, so there was evidence that this was a story because somebody wrote, hey, you want to create a story behind this? And then he replies, definitely. Let's start with names. So they was, okay, so... All right, so on the surface, it's not what it seems. And while they're talking about this, they're showing Stephen King movies, they're showing Saw movies from the Saw franchise. So they're trying to equate all that stuff to these movies, these gory movies. And they're interviewing all these authors and these psychiatrists and all this stuff. They're showing scenes from The Dark Knight, and they're trying to equate that to what he was doing to story creation. And so now they're showing Fahrenheit 451, you know, Big Brother type stuff. So it becomes, you know, if this sets a precedence of, you know, getting policed for what you think of what you do online, but don't do in the real world, Is this going to set a precedent of what authority the system has? What authority the system has over us? What kind of power, additional power they have over us? But this dude used the police database. You know, he used his privilege as a cop to do that. So that's different. He took it outside of his house. That's so it's a mixed bag. I get it. I get the argument. It's a mixed bag. But, you know, and that was the real crime. That was an actual real crime. Him using police resources for non-police matters. But also remember, he did say, I'm just afraid of getting caught. So now we see his mom. She's getting some to wear to the sentencing. And she's just talking about how nervous she is. She telling all her friends to pray for her. And she said she just wanted to give him a big hug. So this must be the sentencing. And I'm wondering if she's trying to pick out something for him to wear. Yeah, it must be she's taking. So he lives with her. I don't know, but she's getting geared up to go to the prison and give him his clothes to wear to the sentencing or whatever. And so now we're with his mom in a taxi, riding to the courthouse, and she's just talking about, you know, she hope he don't have to sit in jail for another day, and so she's just trying to get geared up for that. Okay, so we see him walking out of the courthouse, and he's standing on the courthouse step, and he's giving a statement to the press.
I'd like to make a very, very brief statement. I want to take this opportunity to apologize to everyone who's been hurt, shocked, and offended by my infantile actions. I also want to thank my family from day one. Their support never wavered. I've needed that more than anyone will ever know during this impossible situation. Forgive me, I'm tired. I want to go home and spend some time with my family. Thank you very much.
After 17 months in jail, do you feel like justice has been done?
Granting a judgment of acquittal on sufficiency of evidence grounds, which is what the judge granted, is very, very unusual. And it was front page news. And an acquittal means what? It means you're not guilty, okay? It doesn't mean that you're innocent. One could interpret at least some of the things Gill did as something that wasn't completely consistent with innocence. It could be considered an overt act when he went to the police database looking for targets. How are you going to feel if you let him off and he goes out and eats somebody?
So it goes from that guy saying, how would you feel if he, you know, he gets acquitted and then he goes out and eats somebody, to we at Gill's house and his mom is cooking on the stove. So they're paying right into what she's cooking. And they're like, it looked like it's pasta, but it straight looked like body parts. You know, the red sauce and the pasta. So that was a good edit. Anyway, so he's at his mom's house and he's wearing an ankle bracelet. So if he's acquitted, why is he wearing an ankle bracelet? Oh, it must be for the. So what was he acquitted of? Everything? Why is he wearing an ankle bracelet? This is the most pathetic thing. He's crying to his mom that he needs underwear and shit and. Mom, I need this. This is a grown-ass fucking man. So his mom is washing his underwear? This is more cringy than anything. This grown-ass man has his mom doing his underwear while he's drinking the Sam Adams. He's just chilling with his mom, his dog, his mom, and his ankle bracelet. So he's just sitting at home on his couch with his mom eating burritos. And he's like, this was his skeleton. His skeleton in the closet came out. I don't know, man. Them some weird-ass skeletons you got hiding in your closet. Everybody has skeletons. Yeah, but some people's skeletons are worse than others, man. I'm just going to say that. It wasn't like he was watching. It's not even like he was watching like fetish porn. He was talking about eat, like he was talking about this. And maybe he was watching with the kind of porn that murders women and shit. I know there was a movie 8mm with Nicolas Cage. I think that was about that. I can't remember what the name of it, but. It, like, even if he was doing that, that's like, you know, but he's writing about this. At least have a manuscript somewhere. All right. Let's get through this thing. And we hear this guy, Chris Kraft, talking. He's director of clinical services, Johns Hopkins University. And he's just saying what I was talking about earlier, how, you know, people want to try to find out where this come from. Did it come from childhood? Did something happen when he was young? Whatever. And a lot of times, nobody knows where it come from. And sometimes it just comes down to this is what he chose and he can unchoose it. But one thing that we can't choose is what we are aroused by. And so now it seems like they're just going through a bunch of different experts giving their spin on, you know, what this was really about. overt versus covert sexual arousal and sexual compulsive behaviors, all this different philosophical bullshit, whatever. And now they're interviewing his dad, asking him, did Gil ever ask you about sex growing up? And he said, no, not really. He said, when he went to college, his dad gave him a box of Trojans and said, hey, be careful, don't use them all in once. Hey, man, that's better than what I ever had. He said, but he just laughed and he took them. And we hear this fetish expert. She wrote this book about fetish sex. And she's saying it seems like he grew up in a household where nobody really ever talked about sex. Is there a household where people just sit around and talk about sex? And now his mom is trying to, you know, she's saying that she thought about what led him to get on these sites. And she's wondering if it had anything to do with their divorce. Okay, here we go. The old divorce, you know. And we're going back and forth from mom and dad. The interviewer asked dad, why did you guys get a divorce? And dad don't want to get into it. That means he was probably beating the shit out of mom. Or maybe he was looking up how to eat women. Ask mom. Why didn't ask mom why they got a divorce? And Gil is just saying he was so young, he didn't even really understand what was going on, you know, about divorce. His memories of them involved a lot of arguments. They weren't many happy times. His dad was possessive, controlling, verbally abusive, and she didn't want her son growing up thinking that's how you treat a woman. Yet he grew up thinking a lot worse of women, or the devil made him do it. So he's been had this stuff bottled up all these years, according to him. And these chats was the first time he was able to just open up about it. And this is not just normal, like bondage. I'm watching this. There's this still picture on the screen. This lady, she has hooks in her back. Like hooks, and she's propped up by hooks in her skin and barbed wire. I mean, in these texts, these messages he's writing, if these are the true messages, he's just saying shit like, I really want her to suffer. I'm a little different. And he's saying he's incapable of violence. He couldn't hurt a fly. First of all, you're a fucking liar because you're a cop. So that's okay. So I don't believe nothing you say after this. You couldn't hurt a fly, but you were carrying a badge and a gun. So, and this Coker guy is saying, like, yeah, even though he was acquitted of kidnapping, he still wrote a shitload of stuff about him wanting to do the stuff he was saying. So how do you prove he would never do this in the future? Okay, so now going back to the trial, there's this guy, Park Dietz. He's a forensic psychiatrist. And I guess he's a titan in the field of forensic psychiatry. He interviewed John Hinckley Jr. He's interviewed Joe Rifkin, Andrea Yates, and almost without exception, he works for the prosecution. And this is what he writes in his statement. He says, in my opinion, there's no reliable evidence to suggest that his erotic conversations could reasonably be construed as conspiratorial plans rather than conversations that were an end in themselves. What the fuck does that mean? A bunch of nonsense. Let me read that again. In my opinion, there is no reliable evidence to suggest that his erotic conversation could reasonably be construed as conspiratorial plans rather than conversations that were an end in themselves. Okay. So the conclusion he drew is that this guy is safe as you and me. So that's from the prosecution's expert. Okay. So of course, so that must have been in like a pretrial. And then, well, actually, so the video footage they're showing, it could be from another trial. And that statement he wrote was just to the prosecutors, and they decided not to use him in the trial. Yeah. If he said that, Why would you use them? Okay, now we're hearing this guy, Michael Wellner. He's a forensic psychiatrist and founder of the depravity scale. That's a depravity scale? And this is what he has to say.
Were Dr. Dietz to have actually testified that deviant sexual fantasy doesn't relate at all to those who sadistically rape and who sadistically murder, he would have been slaughtered on cross-examination. Dr. Dietz himself has written about how people with sexually violent intentions, not just fantasies, but offenders to be, may seek out law enforcement positions because of their ability to more easily access prey. But the defense suggests that Officer Valley was indulging in these cannibalistic chats and websites because he was coping. So let me get this right. This kind of behavior is coping? You show me one sex offender treatment program that tells people, go on the internet and cope with your deviant sexual arousal by just engaging with chats about cannibalism people. What a therapeutic remedy.
A psychiatrist that was retained by the defense said that looking at these websites was a way to cope with those urges. In your experience, have you heard of anything like this?
No. I have not heard of anything like that. I don't know that I would say that looking at those websites is a way to cope with or manage those urges. I would personally not prescribe that to a patient and say, well, if you're having these violent fantasies, just look at websites online and that'll help quell those thoughts and urges. In fact, I would wonder whether it would excite those urges if you exercise certain neural pathways. What happens is there's a certain reward circuitry that gets activated in the brain, and when you reach a certain threshold, it becomes a habitual or compulsive pattern. And the pathways to the prefrontal cortex that are responsible for judgment and reasoning and making good decisions shut down simultaneously. So you have a combination of elevated pleasurable stimuli in the brain with poor judgment.
Okay, so we finally meet his wife. So this is an actress reading courtroom testimony from Kathleen Valley, which is his wife. So this is an actress. This is what I'm hearing now is not her voice. This is a recorded testimony from an actress. And what she's saying is he would always say that because he's home so late, he couldn't go right to sleep. So he would play video games, watch TV, go on the internet for a couple hours. Then after she got pregnant, it kept getting worse. He would stay up until 3, 4, 5 in the morning or just not come to sleep in the bed. And so then all this really weird stuff started happening. And now we hear him saying that his wife had installed spyware on their computer. And then she found everything. She found it all. That's how, okay, so she put a keylogger. So she was no dummy. A lot of times you hear about these relationships where the wife was just fucking potato heads. Like this dude was just, I mean, he wasn't even being secretive about it. She was just a dummy about what he was doing. No, not this chick. She fucking put a keylogger on his computer. She knew. See, that's what I'm saying, man. She knew what this dude was up to. Something about him gave off vibes to her. Like she knew what the fuck was going on. But let me say this. I used to, like, my wife and I, we used to work rotating shifts. When we first, well, actually that's how we met. We met in the military. And we were working rotating shifts and shit. And when I would work mids and get off work, or if I worked a swing and got off at, you know, midnight, and when she was off, when she wasn't working, yeah, I wouldn't go get into bed, but I would be like on a couch watching TV, eating chips or something. I wouldn't, you know what I mean? Like, so that part is, there's nothing weird about that. I don't think there's nothing weird about that at all. Because you've been up, you've been hammering energy drinks, you've been hammering coffee just to stay up. And then when you get home, now you're like, you know, you can't just fall right asleep. But I mean, everybody's different. So I don't think that part was weird. So it was something else, or maybe she's not expressing how in detail. Maybe she was like, come up and get this cooter. And he was like, nah, I want to get on this internet. See, it wasn't like that. If my wife was like, come and get this cooter, when I would get off of me, it would be no questions asked. Like, you know, but if she's asleep and, you know, and I don't want to go up there and disturb her, then yeah, I would just hang out on the couch until I'm like damn near passing out. Then I go get into bed. I do that now. Like even if we, you know, we watch an episode or something on TV, we lay down to go to sleep. If I start tossing and turning, I get up and go do something. I don't just keep tossing and turning. But she said this dude is acting sus about something. So it was something else going on. So the key logger, not only does it log keys, it captures images. It does all kinds of stuff, man. Reviews, chats, it tracks email. This she put the heavy duty program on the computer. And so she's saying there was all these websites that she's never seen, darkfetish.net, sexy Amazons, motherless fet life, dark fet, all this bullshit. And she said she knew that, you know, fetish was in at the time, 50 Shades of Grey and all that, but she said this was different. The girls on the front page were dead. So she said she noticed on one of the pictures that, you know, it took a screenshot, the software she put on took a screenshot. She came across this email, mhale52@yahoo.com, and she went on the Yahoo, put in the email address and put the password in that she had. And also he was emailing people. And then she said all of a sudden she was staring at pictures of her friends, pictures of people they knew, thousands and thousands of pictures. And then she confronted him that morning and then left with the baby. So then she wasn't fucking around. So he said he didn't really know what she was planning on doing or how long she was planning on staying, you know, wherever she went. And so we see this back and forth text. She's like, I really need to know who you really are. And he's saying, right now I'm betrayed and terrified. And she's saying, I need the truth about everything. And then she asks, I need to know, did you ever put me or the baby up on email or site? And he said, absolutely not. And that was a lie, because in this email we see picture number 6, Kathleen, 26-year-old, 5'7", 150 to 160 pounds, married and has a baby daughter. And this was an email from Valley for a 4th of July menu containing photo of his wife, Kathleen. And so we see this other message saying her name is Kathleen. She has a lot of meat on her ass, thighs, and calves. Yeah, this dude is fucking deplorable, man. And we just hear Kathleen reading this stuff back, saying all this stuff she wrote about, that he wrote about her. All the suffering he wanted her to go through for his enjoyment, and that he had no remorse. And this dude is still in denial. He's never once saying, to write that about your wife, come on, man. The fact that he's not saying he's sorry he did that to his wife, that tells you a lot right there. That tells you a lot. He never once said, I'm a piece of shit for writing that about my wife, even though I didn't mean it. I'm a piece of shit. Yeah, man. The fact that he hasn't apologized for that, that tells you right there. Okay, so according to him, he closed all of his accounts the night before Kathleen discovered the site. Oh, okay. Yeah, right. So the night before she happens to discover it, you were like, okay, I'm done. Man, fuck off, dude. Fuck off. And how, they keep showing this guy eat. Like, how many times can y'all show him eating? Fuck, we get it. He's trying to tell his mom. His mom probably believe it. I think this dude's a psychopath, man, because I think he thinks just because he says something, people are going to believe it. Okay, so here's a chat with Moody Blues, 9/8/2012, 2 days before Kathleen leaves. And Moody Blues is the guy in England. It says, I closed out my DFM account. And he says, why? And it says, less chance of getting caught, I figure. And that was it. And remember, the jury found him guilty. A jury of his peers found him guilty. It was the judge that acquitted him. They overturned the jury's ruling. That was the judge thing. I wonder why. I bet that judge was probably on one of those sites. The judge was probably one of his online buddies. And we hear Juror X again. Remember the lady that had her face blacked out? She said she felt betrayed. She felt betrayed that the judge came back and overturned their ruling.
The trip to Maryland was planned to meet this college friend, and he was bringing his wife and his daughter along on this trip. The defense maintained that this was just a trip to visit a friend, but his chats with Moody Blues indicated that he couldn't wait to go see her, that he couldn't wait to think about what he was going to do to her, and also find out where she worked and get some more background information. It was proven that he did drive by her office, because he had texted to her about, was that your building? Apparently the building has some significance on this road. He did meet her for brunch with his wife and his daughter, and all seemed normal, just friends getting together and talking, and her meeting his wife and his daughter. A normal person in real life comes back from a road trip. They've been driving, they've been with their family and their baby, and they come home and they unpack and they relax and they figure out what they're gonna do for dinner. Based on the timeline, this man went straight to his computer and straight to his friend to chat, almost like he was reporting in, and you could tell he was excited about it. The fact that he came back from this trip and one of the first things he did was write to Moody Blues. was enough to say that he had made this trip, he had a purpose for this trip, he satisfied that purpose, and he shared it with his conspirator. And that, I think, ultimately led to his downfall.
So he's saying that, you know, a big portion of the evidence was, you know, the when the line was crossed from fantasy to reality was when he made that trip to Maryland. And I would tend to agree, because it wasn't like he just went to Maryland to see his friend. It was the fact that he told this dude online, I'm planning this trip to go see her, right? And previous to that, he offered her up as one of the targets, just like he did his wife. So the fact that he offered her up as one of his targets, his fantasy targets, and then in real life, it's not like he lied to the dude online and said, hey, yeah, I went to see her, blah, blah, whatever. No, he actually went to see her. And as soon as he came back, he wrote in the chat, said she looked absolutely mouth watering. Yeah, so that is when you cross the line from fantasy to reality. I think to me, it's cut and dry, because it's like if someone's planning a bank robbery, they online is fantasy. And then they say, oh, I plan to go visit the bank today. And they go to the bank, but they don't deposit no money. They don't withdraw any money. And maybe it's not even that bank. They just go to the bank. They walk around and they go back home and get online and say, I visited the bank and there's two security guards. It looks easy. No cameras. It looks easy. Right? Isn't that planning? And he's saying this. His mom is just like, you know, I want to see what his dad would say about that. Because his mom seemed like this dude can do no wrong. Like, they could have found the body. Also, part of the evidence was Kimberly Sawyer, the chick he went to see, was the target of police database search July 21st, 2011. So why are you searching it for looking her up? If she's a friend from Maryland, you have her phone number, you're in contact with her. Why are you searching? Why are you in the police database looking? What are you looking at in the police database? And so here's another friend, Andrea Noble. And these are all, he's in pictures with both these women that he targeted in his database. So he looked this chick up and here he is in a picture with her. Maureen Hartigan. He targeted her. He searched her up on May 31st, 2012. Okay, so I guess he didn't give what the defense was trying to say is he didn't give them their last name. He gave them their first name. Why, if it's fantasy, why is he using real people he know name, period? That's the part that don't make sense. If it's a fantasy, why are you using real people name and why are you searching up real people? If it's a fantasy, you just make up shit. Okay, so this guy, the reporter, he's saying there's a part in the chats that Moody Blues asks, what's her address? They don't say who he's asking about, but he says, may I have her address for Googling using the map app? And then Gil writes back, not sure her exact address. Okay, not like I'll, and this is the guy in England, Moody Blue. He said, okay, not like I'll get there a day early. You've all the stuff to prep her. Then he says, gotta go. And so this guy is saying, like, this is just Gil having the hots for somebody, so he used the police database instead of Google. Nah, fuck that. You use Facebook or something. You know, why would you? So he's an idiot. He's dumb then. If nothing else, he's stupid. So what this lady's saying is that what they should have done, they should have set up sort of a sting operation. The cops should have, you know, when his wife, because his wife is the one who blew the whistle on all this. She took it to the cops, like, hey, one of your fellow brothers in blue, this is what he's doing. And this lady has a valid point. I can't remember her name. She has a valid point. She said they should have created a fake account, watched him online, reached out to him, and set up, you know, to sort of get more evidence on him. So I guess they just went with what the stuff the wife had. I mean, she had enough. She had been tracking this dude. So they should have gathered. Yeah, that does make sense. And I guess I was under the impression that they did that, but I guess they didn't. Yeah, they should have set up a fake online account and start to see what this guy's real intentions were. That is valid. That's valid. That's a valid point. So what they did do, they didn't do it for him, but because of him, they did it for other people. They set up these sting operations and they were able to catch this guy, this Christopher Ash, this other dude looking like a politician, Richard Meltz. And this one guy, Christopher Ashe, he actually went so far as to create a kit. He started actually gathering the material, the tools, the kidnap kit, the rape kit, these items of torture, all this stuff. He actually collected this stuff. Get like barbecue skewers, rope. What is it? Matches, hooks, fetish, ball gag, all kinds of shit. Mallet. So this dude was the real deal. Needles, handcuffs, speculums, stun gun, gloves, cleaning stuff. Okay, yeah. So I guess that is the contrast to what Gil was doing. Gil didn't do that. Even though he said he did, he never did. So there are actual guys out there that's for real. Then we hear this lady, Lee Rowland, and she works for the American Civil Liberties Union. And she said, there's always this question of reasonable doubt, because unless you catch somebody with a knife in someone's stomach, there's always reasonable doubt. Like the guy before her was saying, until the guy's in the car with the rope, with the chloroform, on his way to the victim, until then you don't have enough. But then that's still not enough to some people. So some people might say, well, it's not until you got in the car, you got the chloroform, you got the knife, you got the stun gun, you get to the person's house, the victim's house, you get up, you ring the doorbell, the person opened the door. That's enough. But still, reasonable doubt is still there, because that person may have invited them in. They may got some kinky stuff going on. And then you got some people that say it's not until that person is tied up, they've been chloroformed, the person is there with them. Nobody saw it. Only two people in the house, the victim and the perpetrator, in quotes, and that person ends up dying. There's still reasonable doubt, because it could have been a kinky ass sex game gone wrong. Reasonable doubt is like, what is that? It's like you see on cop shows all the time. What do they always do when there's a serial killer or somebody on the loose? What do they always do? Wait for the next victim. You know, they watching the guy and they got to catch him in the act of doing it. It seems like there's a thin line between reasonable doubt and common sense. You know what I mean? It seems like there's that gray area to where what do you think his intentions were? He has a jury of his peers. What are these 12 people? The majority of these 12 people, what do they think his intentions were? But then you have a judge that can override that. So after more than 4 months under house arrest, he's sentenced for illegal use of police database. Sentenced to time served for illegal accessing a police database. He will be released from house arrest. Now he can go out and kidnap some people and eat them. And so there's a text from his wife. It says, I think part of you wants me back, but part of you wants to kill me. And then she further says, I don't know which Gil is real. I'm afraid I don't know you at all. Lady, stay the fuck away from this dude. I hope she stayed away from him. And let me say this. So when we say, they keep saying thought police, thought. Okay, so if he was writing in a private journal, but just going on these sites and just offering up your wife, like telling this dude your wife, giving her real name, saying she... giving her specs, her body makeup, and saying she has a daughter. Man, that's different. You use her real fucking name. That's going past just thinking. I'm willing to believe, like he said, he would do this shit if he was guaranteed not to get caught. He would totally do this stuff. So he's still waiting on news of the appeal. I forgot all about that. So the prosecutors are still appealing. So now he's just waiting on that decision. He's stressing out about that. I don't think they're going to do it, because it's like 8 minutes left in this documentary. So the prosecutors has until midnight to file the official appeal paperwork. And again, he's eating. So now he's just sitting around waiting on midnight to see if the deadline passed. So we had 2 hours to go until the deadline, 1 hour to go. So midnight passed, he's on some website. So there's another person in the house that they haven't, this must be his brother or something, because it kind of looks like him. So he's on something called Cases Selection Table, and I think he's talking to his lawyer. And he's calling his lawyer, he's trying to figure out what this is he's looking at. Okay, so they did file the appeal around 7:30. So they filed this shit. They were looking at the wrong stuff. They had already filed it like 7. So why the fuck did his lawyer call him? They've been sitting there waiting all this time. His lawyer didn't even notify him that at 7 o'clock they had filed the appeal. And you know, to be honest with you, man, you know, I've been talking a lot of shit. Outside of it being some scumbaggery shit, and outside of him going to see that girl, unless there's something else that they haven't brought up, like some other evidence, I don't think they have a case. especially if the judge can override. I mean, they have a case, but they're going to need more. They're going to need like they got the other guy who actually had a kit. They're going to need something like that. They're going to need to see that he purchased something. If he looked into renting some cabin, they're going to have to find something else. I don't think they have a case, especially if they come back with the same thing. And if the judge has the same power, they're just going to run into the same wall. So the prosecution of Gilberto Valle continues. Okay, 3 months later. Now he's just driving around in his car 3 months later. And he's saying, let's hope that his cell phone is not 3 miles away from somebody he went to high school with. So I guess all those girls he was targeting were people he went to high school with. So he's just out. He's out and about like he's going, I don't know whose house, somebody's house he's going to. He's just saying like the first few weeks that he was going out, he realized nobody was recognizing him. Yeah, man, because people forget easy, man. Like they're on to the next scandal, you know? And he thought the next step was to get to dating again. And he's just like, you know, it's been a long time. He wanted to get back to dating. And he's just wondering, like, you know, if he started dating, at what point did he bring this whole shit up? Immediately. Well, not immediately. You don't want to scare him off. The second date, because you don't want to find it out on her own. That'd be creepy. You won't have any problem finding somebody who's all right with the shit habit. Man, there's all kinds of weirdo ass chicks out here. I'm surprised he didn't have women trying to contact him while he was in jail. I think when his daughter gets older and she hears about this shit. Oof.
I don't know. There have to be people out there who are interested, but some people are going to think I should be locked up for the rest of my life. There's no getting around that. I made a bad mistake, a really bad mistake. You know, it's not going to cost me the rest of my life.
Gilberto Valle, known as the Cannibal Cop, just made a dating profile on Match.com.
What's he list under some of his likes? Cooking.
I mean, this was really a bad guy. I don't want to be a buzzkill, but, you know, ew.
So at the end of this, there was a dedication in memory of David Carr. David Carr was an American columnist, author, and newspaper editor. He wrote the Media Equation column and covered culture for the New York Times. He died February 12, 2015 at 9 p.m. Eastern. He collapsed in a newsroom of the New York Times and was pronounced dead at Mount Sinai Roosevelt Hospital at age 58. The cause of death was lung cancer with heart disease listed as a contributing factor. Okay, that's the end of this episode. Send questions, comments, and requests to docutalkthrough@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.